On a sun-bleached afternoon in the summer of 1985, my teenage tour of Europe grinds to a halt in a square on the outskirts of Rome. The bus back into town is 20 minutes late and shows no signs of appearing. Yet the delay does not bother me. Instead of pacing up and down the pavement or calling the bus company to lodge a complaint, I slip on my Walkman, lie down on a bench and listen to Simon and Garfunkel singing about the joys of slowing down and making the morning last. Every detail of the scene is engraved on my memory. Two small boys kick a football around a medieval fountain. Branches scrape against the top of a stone wall. An old widow carries her vegetables home in a net bag. Fast forward 15 years, and everything has changed. The scene shifts to Rome's busy Fiumicino Airport, and I'm a foreign correspondent rushing to catch a flight home to London. Instead of kicking down the cobblestones and feeling groovy, I dash through the departure lounge, silently cursing anyone who crosses my path at a slower pace. Rather than listen to music on a cheap Walkman, I talk on a mobile phone to an editor thousands of miles away. At the gate, I join the back end of a long queue where there is nothing to do except, well, nothing. Only I am no longer capable of doing nothing. To make the wait more productive, to make it seem less like waiting, I start skimming a newspaper. And that is when my eyes come upon the article that will inspire me eventually to write a book about slowing down. The words that stop me in my tracks are the one-minute bedtime story. To help parents deal with time-consuming tots, authors condense classic fairy tales into 60-second sound bites. Think Hans Christian Andersen meets the executive summary. My first reflex is to shout Eureka. At the time, I am locked in a nightly tug-of-war with my two-year-old son, who favours long stories read at a gentle, meandering pace. Every evening, though, I steer him towards the shortest books and read them quickly. We often quarrel. "You're going too fast," he cries. Or, as I make for the door, "I want another story." Part of me feels horribly selfish accelerating the bedtime ritual, but another part simply cannot resist the itch to hurry on to the next thing on my agenda. Supper, emails, reading, bills, more work, the news bulletin on television. Taking a long, languid stroll through the world of Dr. Seuss is not an option. It is too slow. So at first glance, the one-minute bedtime series sounds almost too good to be true. Rattle off 6 or 7 stories and still finish inside 10 minutes. What could be better? Then, as I begin to wonder how quickly I can get the full set, redemption comes in the shape of a counter-question. Have I gone completely insane? As the departure queue snakes towards the final ticket check, I put away the newspaper and begin to think. My whole life has turned into an exercise in hurry, in packing more and more into every hour. I am Scrooge with a stopwatch, obsessed with saving every last scrap of time, a minute here, a few seconds there. And I am not alone. Everyone around me, colleagues, friends, family, is caught in the same vortex. In 1982, Larry Dossey, an American physician, coined the term time sickness to describe the obsessional belief that time is getting away, that there isn't enough of it, and that you must pedal faster and faster to keep up. These days, the whole world is time-sick. We all belong to the same cult of speed. In these early years of the 21st century, everything and everyone is under pressure to go faster. Not long ago, Klaus Schwab, founder and president of the World Economic Forum, spelled out the need for speed in stark terms. We are moving from a world in which the big eat the small to one in which the fast eat the slow. That warning resonates far beyond the Darwinian world of commerce. In these busy, bustling times, everything is a race against the clock. Guy Claxton, a British psychologist, thinks acceleration is now second nature to us. We have developed an inner psychology of speed, of saving time and maximizing efficiency, which is getting stronger by the day. Before we go any further, though, Let's make one thing clear. This is not a declaration of war against speed. Speed has helped to remake our world in ways that are wonderful and liberating. Who wants to live without the internet or jet travel? The problem is that our love of speed, our obsession with doing more and more with less and less time, has gone too far. It's turned into an addiction, a kind of idolatry. Even when speed starts to backfire, we invoke the go-faster gospel. Falling behind at work, get a quicker internet connection. No time for that novel you got at Christmas? Learn to speed read. Diet not working? Try liposuction. Too busy to cook? Buy a microwave. And yet some things cannot, should not, be sped up. They take time. They need slowness. When you accelerate things that should not be accelerated, when you forget how to slow down, there is a price to pay. In this media-drenched, data-rich, channel-surfing, computer-gaming age, we have lost the art of doing nothing, of shutting out the background noise and distractions, of slowing down and simply being alone with our thoughts. Boredom, the word itself hardly existed 150 years ago, is a modern invention. Remove all stimulation and we fidget, panic, and look for something, anything to do to make use of the time. When did you last see someone just gazing out of the window on a train? Everyone is too busy reading the paper, playing video games, listening to music, working on the laptop, yammering into mobile phones. Our impatience is now so implacable that, as actress author Carrie Fisher quipped, even instant gratification takes too long. This partly explains the chronic frustration that bubbles just below the surface of modern life. Anyone or anything that steps in our way, that slows us down, that stops us getting exactly what we want when we want it, becomes the enemy. So the smallest setback, the slightest delay, the merest whiff of slowness can now provoke vein-popping fury in otherwise ordinary people. The anecdotal evidence is everywhere. In Los Angeles, a man starts a fight at a supermarket checkout because the customer ahead of him is taking too long to pack his groceries. A woman scratches the paintwork of a car that beats her to a parking spot in London. A company executive tears into a stewardess when his plane is forced to spend an extra 20 minutes circling Heathrow Airport before landing. "I want to land now," he shouts like a spoiled child. "Now! Now! Now!" This is where our obsession with going fast and saving time leads to road rage, air rage, shopping rage, relationship rage, office rage, gym rage. Thanks to speed, we live in the age of rage. After my bedtime story epiphany at the airport in Rome, I returned to London with a mission to investigate the price of speed and the prospects for slowing down in a world obsessed with going faster and faster. We all moan about frenzied schedules, but is anybody actually doing anything about it? Yes, it turns out. While the rest of the world roars on, a growing minority is choosing not to do everything at full throttle. In every human endeavour you can think of, from sex, work and exercise, to food, medicine and urban design, these rebels are doing the unthinkable. They are making room for slowness. And the good news is that decelerating works. Today, more and more people are refusing to accept the diktat that faster is always better. And in their many and diverse acts of deceleration lie the seeds of a global slow movement. Now is the moment to define our terms. Here, fast and slow do more than just describe a rate of change. They are shorthand for ways of being or philosophies of life. Fast is busy, controlling, aggressive, hurried, analytical, stressed, superficial, impatient, active, quantity over quality. Slow is the opposite. Calm, careful, receptive, still, intuitive, unhurried, patient, reflective, quality over quantity. It is about making real and meaningful connections with people, culture, work, food, everything. The paradox is that slow does not always mean slow. As we shall see, performing a task in a slow manner often yields faster results. It is also possible to do things quickly while maintaining a slow frame of mind. One leading proponent of deceleration is Carlo Petrini, the Italian founder of Slow Food, the international movement dedicated to the very civilized notion that what we eat should be cultivated, cooked, and consumed at a relaxed pace. And though the dinner table is its chief battlefront, slow food is much more than an excuse for long lunches. The group's manifesto is a call to arms against the cult of speed in all its forms. Inevitably, the slow movement overlaps with the anti-globalization crusade. Both believe that turbo-capitalism offers a one-way ticket to burnout for the planet and the people living on it. Both claim we can live better if we consume, manufacture, and work at a more reasonable pace. But the slow movement goes much deeper than mere economic reform. By taking aim at the false god of speed, it strikes at the heart of what it is to be human in the era of the silicon chip. The slow movement is still taking shape. It has no central headquarters or website, no single leader, no political party to carry its message. Many people decide to slow down without ever feeling part of a cultural trend, let alone a global crusade. What matters, though, is that a growing minority is choosing slowness over speed, because every act of deceleration gives another push to the slow movement. Like the anti-globalization crowd, slow activists are forging links, building momentum, and honing their philosophy through international conferences, the internet, and the media. Pro-slow groups are springing up all over the place. Some, such as Slow Food, focus mainly on one sphere of life. Others make a broader case for the slow philosophy. Among these are Japan's Sloth Club, the US-based Long Now Foundation, and Europe's Society for the Deceleration of Time. Much of the slow movement's growth will come from cross-pollination. Slow Food has already given rise to spin-off groups. Under the Slow Cities banner, over 60 towns in Italy and beyond have pledged to turn themselves into oases of calm. In the US, the Petrini Doctrine has inspired a leading educator to launch a movement for slow schooling. My aim is to introduce the slow movement to a wider audience, to explain what it stands for, how it is evolving, what obstacles it faces, and why it has something to offer us all. My motives, however, are not entirely selfless. I am a speedaholic. And so this is also a personal journey. By the end of it, I want to recapture some of the serenity I felt waiting for that bus in Rome. I want to be able to read to my son without watching the clock. Like most people, I want to find a way to live better by striking a balance between fast and slow.